The canny cache was most impressive, assembled, no doubt, from the vills they had looted and the convoys they had ambushed. One wall of the room was lined with long, flat wooden boxes, weapons crates clearly marked as AK-47s of Egyptian and Polish manufacture. They were open 55-gallon drums of loose 7.62mm Comblock ammunition and bins of 30-round AK magazines still wrapped in cosmoline. In a far corner, there were a few more drums, however, these were still hermetically sealed. If their labeling was accurate, they contained enough RDX high explosive to turn the freighter into a mile-wide circle of smoking scrap. The last Cajun through the door pulled it closed behind him. JB walked straight over to a long rack of RPG-16s. Beside it were crates of individually bubble-wrapped heat rockets. A pair of canny armorers rose from a cluttered work table in the center of the room.
What can we do for you, folks?
You can die.
Cheetah Luis pointed his assault rifle at the man's chest. Cajun swept in behind the pair and slipped wire nooses over their heads. After that, there was no more talking. Just kicking.
JB, better start prepping the blasters. As many as you can.
I'm on it. Need some help loading the mags, though.
Cheetah Luis pointed at three of his fighters.
You, and you. Stay here and help him.
As the rest of the companions and Cajuns turned to leave, JB began checking the brand new blasters, making sure actions and barrels were clear, and dry-firing them before loading them up with fresh mags. The next hold contained the stores of gasoline. Wooden pallets were stacked with full 55-gallon steel drums.
This will make a pretty boom.
Need to make triple sure it ignites. Give me a hand.
With the help of Doc and Sprue, Ryan pried the lids off a half dozen drums, then dumped the contents onto the deck under the rows of pallets. The Cajuns followed suit, emptying a dozen more. The fumes were dizzying. They hurried back out into the hall, shutting the hold's door after them, sealing in the explosive vapor. At the far end of the corridor was the door that led to the captive hold. There were no cannies standing guard. The lock was a simple but massive steel crossbar arrangement. Doc immediately began to lift it up.
Don't open it, Doc. We can't free them yet. We've got to wait. If Mildred and Jack are inside, they're safe for the moment. We can't afford to show our hand too soon.
They retraced their steps down the corridor, past the armory to the stairway door. They descended the stairs to B deck, where the canny hag had told them the crew quarters were. The freighter's second level was even danker and moldier than the first. The floors were slick with a thin film of slime. The metal walls and ceiling sweated orange drops of corrosion. They found the crew quarters in the bow end of the hall. Again, the door was wide open, perhaps in faint hope of snagging a fresh breeze. Unlike the rooms in the deck above, the riveted ceiling was low. It, too, was lit by smoky torches, which only added to the caustic bear pit smell. String hammocks hung like insect cocoons from the girders overhead. About half were occupied by sleeping cannies, some in stained underwear, some fully clothed. Below the hammocks, their weapons were neatly stowed.
What do you think?
At least another 50.
Too many to chill without using blasters and raising a ruckus.
Nobody woke up. Nobody noticed when they slipped back out into the corridor.
The door is solid steel. We can jam it shut from the outside. There aren't any windows for them to crawl through. They don't know it yet, but that room is going to be their coffin.
On the bottom deck, they found the ship's engine room, which was deserted and dark. They had to take down torches from the hull to see inside. The engine's immense, elephant-like back stuck up from a sump of black oil, surrounded by a catwalk. Its cylinders were as tall as a man. At the other end of the hall, there were signs of life, and the overpowering stench of mass death. They pushed through the double-swing metal doors into the meat hold. Inside, men and women in orange vests labored over the fruits of the canny harvest. At workstations around the room, they barbered, disemboweled, and drained hanging carcasses. Even Ryan, the seasoned warrior, was taken aback at the sight. His blood ran cold, and he tasted acrid bile in the back of his throat. This was the sub-basement of hell. Ryan looked at Doc, worried that he wouldn't be able to control himself. But Doc seemed just fine. The Cajuns were the ones who lost it, when they recognized their own kin being butchered. Cheetah Luis walked over to a steel-topped table and picked up a large wooden mallet used for hammering a blade through bone. He tested its weight in his hand. The worker behind the table beamed at him, his face and vest spattered with blood and bits of fat. With an overhead swing of the mallet, Cheetah Luis crushed the top of the worker's skull like a raw egg, from crown to temple, dropping him like a stone. The other Cajuns took that as a signal for the mayhem to begin. They rushed through the room, grabbing up cleavers and boning knives from the tabletops. They hurled the butchers into their own chopping blocks and pinned them down while they hacked and stabbed their vengeance. Cheetah Luis then moved through his fighters, some of whom were already weeping, roughly shoving them toward the swing doors.
Go on! Get out! Get out!
This wasn't the time for mourning the dead. At the aft end of C deck, they located the fuel oil bunker. From the indicator gauges, it looked like 10,000 gallons remained in the double-walled tanks.
Fuel oil is nowhere near as flammable as gas, but under the right conditions of high temperature and pressure, kaboom.
At Cheetah Luis's gesture, his fighters delved into their packs for some of the pipe bombs they had brought along. He showed them where he wanted them positioned, near the ceiling, their 6-inch-long fuses pointing up. They used strips of duct tape to secure the bombs in place.
What do you think, Ryan?
I think we'd better be a hell of a long way off when this shit hits the fan.
Mildred pulled Jack away from the captive Cajuns.
I'm the only one who can get out of here, Jack. All I have to do is yell up to Junior that I'm ready to give in.
You gonna give in?
No, but he won't find that out until it's too late.
What you do alone?
More than I can do down here. Maybe I can get close enough to the Queen to take her out. Maybe I can find a way to open that door and let the prisoners loose.
Good luck.
Mildred stood directly under the open hatch and looked up.
Junior! Junior!
After a minute, the scar-faced bastard peered down at her.
You got something to say to me?
I'm ready for some dinner!
Thibodeau gestured to someone on the main deck. As the net came down, Mildred felt a wave of relief course over her. She hadn't told Jack the whole truth. She hadn't dared speak her fears out loud. Mildred had another reason for wanting out of the hold. What Junior had predicted was coming to pass. There was a terrible pounding in her head and a building tension at her core. Her body throbbed, crying out for action, release from the pressure that gripped it. She wasn't hungry for flesh, she knew that. The aching need inside her hadn't solidified into compulsion. Not yet, anyway. That was the last turn of the oozy screw. If she waited for it to come, Jack Lauren wasn't safe from her, nor were any of the other innocent people in the hold. Mildred stepped onto the net and rode up and out of the pit. Up on the main deck, Junior had a charred joint waiting for her. He waved it under her nose.
Chow down. This is a choice cut. You're gonna love it.
I want to see La Golondrina first.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not kidding.
Everybody who comes on this ship wants an audience with her. Nobody gets one. Understand?
Listen, Junior, I'm a freezy, just like her. I need to talk to La Golondrina.
Don't look like a fucking freezy to me.
How many freezies have you seen?
Just the one.
Junior gestured up at the tower with his thumb.
Congratulations. Now you've seen two.
How do I know you telling me the truth?
You don't, but she will.
Why should La Golondrina care if you're all freezy?
Because I was a research white coat before the nuke cost. With what's in my head, I can help her big time. I can turn the canny groundswell into a tidal wave.
Thibodeau scowled, obviously weighing the personal cost benefit.
It'll be a feather in your cap, too. La Golondrina is going to be mighty happy you had the smarts to introduce us. I'm talking a major reward, maybe even a command of your own. Or if you're too scared to help me out, I can always ask one of these other fine flesh eaters for a hand.
All right, all right. I'll give it a try. You're probably not going to get past the angels anyway.
Mildred followed him down the deck to the bridge tower. As they got closer, she could see two huge bare-chested men guarding the entrance at its base. She recalled what Junior had told her, that the Angels of Death were part of La Golondrina's original hunting pack. The first partakers of the cure. What passed for canny royalty. So as not to be mistaken for lesser beings, this pair of bruisers sported some unique skin art. Life-size human skulls had been branded into the middle of their chests. Ropey, red scar tissue made the elaborate design stick out from their flesh. They looked as if they had been sculpted from blood. More angry branding scars licked like flames over their thick wrists and forearms. Their full beards and long hair had been woven into tight pigtail braids and tied at the ends with leather traces. There was no sign of wings on these angels, All that sprouted from the tops of their shoulders were tufts of coarse dark hair. The cure was evidently still working, though. Not a gray drop leaked from either trauma-flattened nose.
What do you want?
Need to see Lagolandrina.
You know better than that, Scarface.
Mildred could smell the man's cadaver breath from 5 feet away.
Back off or you're gonna lose an arm.
The first one unsheathed the cutlass at his belt and measured the distance for a strike. The long blade was nicked along its length, but the single upcurving edge looked razor sharp, with more than enough thickness and heft along the backbone to do the job right. Junior retreated a step.
This one. She's the one who wants to see like old Andrina.
She's nothing but meat. Why are you bringing her here? Love meat don't go upstairs. That's the rule.
I infected her. She's about to turn candy any minute. I know it.
Why don't we just wait and see then?
Mildred was slammed by a wave of desperation. If her symptoms were a measure of the time she had left, her window of opportunity was rapidly closing.
Okay, listen to me. If you take La Golondrina a message from me and she doesn't want to see me after she hears it, you can chill me.
We can do that anyway. La Golondrina don't like being bothered.
This is important to her. She's going to be mighty angry when she finds out you screwed this up. Maybe she'll withhold the cure next time you need it.
The angels of death looked at each other dubiously. Then the one on the right shrugged.
If she turns you down, we're not going to let you die quick.
I knew it. Damn you, I knew it.
What's the message?
I'm a Freezy Whitecoat, and I can stop her bleeding.
That's it?
That's it.
If that's all you got, you better kiss your ass goodbye.
The guard disappeared through the doorway. As Mildred stood waiting, she tried not to question the strategy she had chosen. In for a penny, in for a pound. The fastest way to soften up the cannies for Ryan and the Cajuns was to kill the woman who was their leader. Under the circumstances, it was the only effective action an army of one could take. If Mildred survived the attack, releasing the prisoners came next. When the angel returned, his face and chest were covered with sweat, and he was panting hard. He had run down the 12 flights of stairs, and not for the privilege of hacking them to bits.
Come on, both of you. Get a move on.
He gestured at the door.
Me too?
The angel grabbed him by the shoulder and shoved him through the entrance. On the other side of the bulkhead door was a stairwell lit by torches. The rusting metal treads led up into the dark. Mildred guessed the bridge tower had to have had an elevator once. It was either no longer operational, or it was reserved for canny royalty. With a torch-bearing angel in front and one behind, she and Thibodeau mounted the steps. A century ago, the ship's stairwell had been enclosed from the weather by a riveted steel plate. The apocalypse, the tsunamis, nuke winter, and chem rains had turned the exterior walls into a cheese grater. Some of the stair treads had corroded away from their mountings. The ascent was much more precarious than Mildred had imagined. All the window glass was missing. Mildred looked out of the empty frames, down onto the tilted deck at the cannies cavorting below. The ship's tower was like a mountaintop pyramid or castle, a symbol of authority. Elevation and separation bred respect and awe in the weak-minded. They mounted more rickety flights, coming out on the unrailed bridge roof. The single-story wheelhouse stood in its center, overlooking the vast main deck. Some of its long, narrow windows were intact. The structure was guarded by four more angels, each wearing a cutlass in addition to slung, folding-stock AK-47s. As Mildred approached the wheelhouse, she could see through the windows. Inside, the control room was lit by torches and lamps. Cozy, but for the sweltering heat. Mildred's chin dripped with sweat, and her underarms felt like they had been buttered. Gauzy brown fabric hung down in billowing channels from the low ceiling, giving it a Bedouin caravan sort of atmosphere. There were no chairs or couches in evidence, just scattered plush cushions, replete with tassels and embroidery. Through one of the empty window frames, Mildred smelled sandalwood incense. Definitely a feminine choice, perhaps to cover the putrefying stench rising from the decks below.
Stand here.
One of their escorts left them and ducked into the wheelhouse. Mildred took a look over the edge of the roof. Below, more bound captives were dragging more bodies up the ramp onto the main deck. The Happy Meals would soon be hauling them away. After a moment, the angel reappeared in the side doorway.
Enter.
Inside the wheelhouse, it was a good 15 degrees hotter. The air was smothering, like breathing steam. At the far end of the room, behind a ceiling-to-floor veil of drooping gauze, faintly sidelit by rows of oil lamps, a figure reclined on a mound of cushions.
Step closer.
Mildred and Junior obeyed. It was impossible to make out the speaker through the folds of brown muslin. As they neared the canopy, Angel stepped forward on either side. Their cutlasses drawn, they were ready to chop down the visitors if they made a hostile move for the Queen.
You know I am La Golondrina. Tell me who you are.
I'm Dr. Mildred Wyeth. I was cryopreserved in December of 1999. I emerged from freezy sleep 100 years later.
Doctor?
Yes, in research, biochemistry, and medicine.
A real-life scientist?
Yes.
Why should I believe you? You could have memorized a couple of big words to try to fool me.
You shouldn't believe me. You should make me prove who I am and what I can do.
And pray tell, what might that be?
I can eliminate the need for you to open your veins. I can cure the oozies without your blood.
La Golondrina was silent. Behind the brown muslin, she didn't move a muscle.
The endless donations of blood must be a terrible drain on your strength and on your psyche. It must make you a prisoner here in your own kingdom.
If you have something to offer me, let's hear it.
I can isolate the active agent in your blood, the antibodies that weaken and suppress the oozy virus. I can synthesize quantities of concentrated pure antivirus through biochemical means. You would have plenty of medicine for your flock, and you would be free to leave this place.
How are you going to do something like that without access to a research lab?
The technology is relatively simple. I can easily scrounge up or jury-rig the hardware I need. The basic methodology is already here.
Mildred tapped her right temple with a fingertip. La Golondrina suddenly reached up and swept aside the gauzy curtain. Something had gone very wrong with La Golondrina's cryopreservation, either in the initial freezing or the subsequent thawing. Parchment-white, flaking skin was stretched over nearly fleshless bone. Her eyes were such a pale blue that they hardly had any color at all. Her lips were so bloodless that they were nearly invisible. Her skin hung down in thin, drooping folds from the backs of her arms and the line of her jaw. Her hair was dyed a lusterless black, its white roots showing in the central part. Her wrists were heavily bandaged, the bandages spotting with red. La Golondrina was a scrawny, blue-veined hag in a slinky, spaghetti-strapped black cocktail dress. Three sizes too big for her. It occurred to Mildred that when the canny queen had gone into the liquid nitrogen tank, she might have already been old. A geezer seeking a cure for aging and the diseases thereof wasn't unheard of in her day.
I do know what you are, but not how you got that way.
When La Golondrina smiled, displaying black-rimmed yellow stumps of teeth, Junior retreated three or four giant steps.
You think you deserve that information?
I guess that's up to you.
It pleases me that you weren't afraid to ask me a question. Thousands would have shit themselves at the very idea. We who have come through cryo are different than the others. We are changed in many ways.
That's so.
Would you believe me if I told you that I have no idea how I came to be infected? And that I only have a rough idea of when?
Without more of the details, I really couldn't say.
As you can imagine, over the years, I've given a lot of thought to the source of my infection, trying to pinpoint what has happened to me. Before the nuke caused, I was interrogated extensively by military intelligence. They asked me about my daily habits and my personal and business contacts over and over again, sometimes using drugs to boost my recon. Nothing added up. I got the feeling from my watchers that they thought what I had wasn't a naturally occurring disease. That it had been tailor-made in a laboratory, perhaps by the Soviet Union, or even by some covert arm of the U.S. government. Containment was what they talked about the most, in front of me and behind my back. They were afraid that whatever it was had already gotten out into the population.
You mean a bioweapon?
That's what they thought.
That would have been in violation of the Geneva Accords.
But think of the payoff. A disease that makes your enemies kill and eat their own people.
How did your symptoms appear?
Out of the blue. One day I was fine, the next I was sick as a dog. The day after that, I was on the hunt. Until I was caught, pre-dark law enforcement thought I was a male serial killer on a murder rampage through the South. Before Skydark, there was no room for an Uzi-infected person like me to come to full flower. You remember what it was like back then? A world cluttered with laws and lawmen. Even so, I couldn't help myself. After a while, I didn't even try. Of course, I didn't look like this then. I was in my late 20s, a Baton Rouge housewife, and I was a babe. I drove around Louisiana on a big old white convertible with the top down, my tanned breasts popping out of my yellow checked sundress, and a big welcoming smile on my face. I had no trouble getting what I wanted. Dumb, young, and tender.
Mildred did the math in her head. La Golondrina was about 31 years old, measured in the time she'd spent outside a cryotank. In other words, she had prematurely aged, as though she had been in an extreme high-altitude, low-oxygen environment for too long, in what pre-dark mountain climbers had called the death zone, the top of Mount Everest, a place where every organ of the body slowly suffocated.
How did you get caught?
I guess you could say I got lazy. I hunted the same territory once too often. The FBI caught me in a dragnet with bloody clothes in my trunk. They didn't know I was the killer until after they put me in the parish's holding cell with two other women. By then, I was too long without food. The cops got it all on videotape. As soon as psychological testing showed law enforcement and the state prosecutor that what I had was a disease and not mental illness, they spirited me off to the Centers for Disease Control. After those folks studied me for a bit, they realized what I had could be transmitted by blood and bodily fluids. Then I really fell off the end of the world. Level 4 containment on an army base in Maryland. The military scientists there tried to evaluate my weaponization.
Weaponized cannibalism?
Back then, I was an Uzi's producing factory. Only they never called it that. They used initials. CJCD. Creutzfeldt something something disease. I didn't come down with terminal symptoms for another year. That's when the white coats finally realized what they had stumbled on. If they could introduce the lethal virus to the opposing side of the battlefield, they could create self-terminating, indiscriminate engines of destruction out of enemy forces. The hypothesis that the disease had come from the Soviets sent them scrambling to find a vaccine. That never happened. Rumors about what was going on leaked to the net. The legitimate press followed up on the story. The scientists had to cover their tracks. That's when they put me in cryostasis in October 1999.
How did they keep you alive before that?
Finding food for me wasn't hard. These were military black ops. They had unlimited secret discretionary funding. They opened a funeral home in Baltimore. The remains meant for cremation came to me on a plate. The grieving families got kitty litter.
How did you get out of cryo?
An accident. A computer malfunction shut down the facility after a century of operation. I didn't thaw right. As you can see, I had cellular damage. However, I came out of cryogenesis oozy symptom-free.
But you're still a canny.
Cure is a relative term, I suppose. The terminal part of the disease is no longer a factor. Residual cannibalism is a minor inconvenience compared to being dead.
Mildred couldn't draw any conclusions as to what brought on the reversal of symptoms and left the behavior in place. There were too many unknowns. The effect of long-term freezing, the nature of the viral disease, and the brain changes attributable to it, prior trauma, and predilections to psychosis and violent antisocial behavior. It was also possible that once a canny, always a canny, that the infection produced an irreversible effect, a permanent scarring of the personality. Mildred had to consider the prospect that the cure might stop her from dying of the Uzis, but not from turning into a canny.
How did you know your blood could cure Uzis?
I didn't at first. But I knew enough about biology from high school and from listening to my captors to figure out I had somehow developed powerful antibodies to the disease. Otherwise, I'd still have been dripping gray pus. I didn't know it would work on anybody else until I tried it on a couple of my packmates. They were goners, so I figured it couldn't hurt them. A few drops of my blood made them rise from the dead.
I always thought the hardships of the nuke winter produced the first cannies, and that the Uzis was something transmitted through their lifestyle, like AIDS.
Cannies and Uzis were already out in the world before Skydark. I'm living proof that cannies were thriving in the hellscape when I stepped out of the tank. I'd like to think I had something to do with that, but there's no way of knowing.
What do you mean?
I could have infected other people before the FBI caught me. I might have been contagious in the disease's early stages. It's also possible that the original source of the canny plague, the lab or bunker or whatever that was responsible for my infection, got breached on Nuke Day or sometime after, and the virus was released into the atmosphere.
I take it you didn't have a plan when you arrived.
A plan? I never thought I'd need one. Never thought I'd end up here, that's for sure. When the scientists prepped me for the cryo with needles and IV lines in my arms, I thought they were going to execute me by lethal injection. I started working out a plan when I saw how my blood cured my sick crew. Deathlanders are really stupid, ignorant fucks, as you must have noticed. They walk in the same shallow, muddy rut until the day they die. They don't know anything about the past, and they don't care to know anything. Me, I got 100 blueprints for conquest from my good old middle school history classes.
Junior Thibodeau qualified as one of the aforementioned really stupid, ignorant fucks. He understood about a third of the words in their conversation and got none of the references to science and few pertaining to history. He positioned himself next to one of the wheelhouse windows where he could sneak an eagle's eye view of the main deck. He suddenly pointed at something interesting below.
Well, looky here.
Mildred took the glee in his voice for a very bad sign. She stepped up behind him and looked over his shoulder. Down on the deck, at the top of the ramp, stood her four longtime companions. Cheetah Luis and his Cajuns were gathered around them. All were fully armed.
We got some...
Before he could finish the warning, Mildred reached around his ribcage with both hands and yanked the captured pistols from his trouser waistband. The canny instinctively clutched at his pants as they came unbuttoned and began to fall down over his hips. While he was thus occupied, Mildred reared back with her right foot and booted him in the base of the spine, hurling him head first through the open window and off the bridge. Flailing his arms and legs, his pants around his ankles, Thibodeau dropped the first three stories. Then he began somersaulting head over heels. When he hit the steel deck, he narrowly missed a crowd of his brethren. Before Mildred could recover her balance, turn, and open fire, the guardian angels were on top of her. One jerked her away from the window, and the other ripped the blasters out of her hands. With an arm securely pinned behind her back, Mildred was walked up to face the canny queen.
Why did you do that?
He had it coming. He infected me with Uzis 2 days ago.
You're definitely a spicy lady.
In that instant, Mildred saw the vile, frail woman as the helpless victim of her own success, trapped by the miraculous power of her blood. Not a reigning monarch or a conquering general, but a prize cow who was drained of precious fluids at regular intervals. The angels of death appeared to be the ones in control of the situation. They had the blasters and swords. They kept her a prisoner in the tower. They supervised the bloodletting and the distribution of the cure to the needy. Mildred expected La Golondrina to embrace the chance at freedom she was offering and thereby give her an opening for attack.
Boil some water and throw her head in it. I feel like spicy soup.
Ryan and the others climbed the stairway to the B-deck landing, where Cheetah Luis dispatched two of his men to stand guard on the crew quarters door.
I want you to do nothing until you hear all hell break loose up top. When you hear that, lock the bastards in nice and tight, and then join us in the bow on the main deck.
Why do we have to wait for the shooting to start? Why can't we just lock them in now?
We don't want to arouse any suspicion before we get things rolling. Some Kenny might come along, see the door jammed, and put two and two together. At the very least, the Kenny's in the crew quarters would get let out before we done up top. That's why you got to wait until the last minute.
The explanation seemed to satisfy the Cajun and her partner. They slipped through the doorway and took off at a trot down the wide, torchlit hall. When the ragtag band reached the A-deck landing, they paused again, preparing to split into two groups, one predominantly Cajun, the other made up entirely of companions. The former was tasked with releasing and arming the prisoners, the latter with the killing of La Golondrina.
How are we going to know when to start the attack on the main deck, Carter? Should we hold off until the firefight breaks out up there?
No, that won't tell you whether we've won or not. You just watch the wheelhouse. We'll let you know when we've taken it.
What if you can't take it? I don't feature waiting around with my thumb up my butt. Now, how long should we wait before we do the job ourselves?
If we don't signal you 5 minutes after the shooting stops up there, you can figure that we're all dead. And the ball's in your court. Don't worry about us. We'll find our own way out.
I wasn't worrying.
Suck it up.
You too.
The Cajun led his fighters through the doorway onto A-deck to pick up JB and the others in the armory. Ryan and the companions continued up the stairs to the exit on the main deck. Looking back from the bow, he gazed down the length of the great dead ship. The tower was a long way off, and there were dozens and dozens of very excited cannies between them and it.
Spread out once we're on the deck. It's okay to hurry along, but don't move in sync like a combat team. We don't want the angels in the tower to pick us out and know what's coming. Blend in with the action. Dance if you have to. Take different routes. We'll meet up at the far end.
Ryan took the point and began weaving his way through the milling flesh-eaters, cutting right and left, even turning sideways as he advanced. Again and again he was slapped hard on the back, congratulated for being something that he wasn't. As he passed the first hatch, he saw the horse-faced woman leaning over the rim with her hands on her knees, pointing down into the captive hold.
I'm going to eat you! Yes, sweetheart, I'm talking to you!
Ryan looked away, repressing a grimace. His face was placid, without a readable expression. But in his mind's eye, he was visualizing all that lay in front of him, destroyed, burning, the capering cannies left in chunks for the buzzards and the flies. As he passed midships, a pair of male cannies crossed his path. They were hauling a corpse by its heels, face down. From the way the top of the head was pancaked like a squeeze box, Ryan guessed it was the body of the person who'd fallen from the tower. Whether it had been a man or woman was impossible to tell. As the cannies dragged the corpse away, the hamburgered face left a glistening red stripe on the deck. When he was beyond the king posts, the crowd suddenly thinned out. For a second, Ryan got a better look at the men standing guard on the tower's main deck entrance. Cheetah Louise had told them that the Angels of Death were the biggest, baddest bastards of all. Ryan had begun to seriously wonder about that assessment. The Angels' only mission was to protect their queen, who, as he understood the setup, wasn't under any threat on this isolated shithole of an island. After their previous unsuccessful attack, her major adversaries, the Cajun fighters, had been reduced to conducting roadside ambushes on the mainland. The only visitors allowed were other cannies, and she was much too valuable for them to ever think about chilling her. The Angels of Death had retired from the stresses and excitement, the skill sharpening of Hunt, and been turned into palace guards, glorified sec men, warriors in name only. No doubt they still did plenty of murder, for their own pleasure and the pleasure of their queen, but killing defenseless captives wasn't the same as fighting an enemy that shot back. They had no competition, so they had no reason to stay on top of their game. Terror and fear kept them in power. It also kept them safe and made them weak. Carter moved closer, halving the distance to the target, then paused at the rail behind a blazing oil drum and adjusted the Steyr's right on his shoulder. Blocking the tower doorway, their brawny arms folded across their bare chests, were two Angels of Death. They were bigger than Ryan had expected, and they seemed in excellent physical shape. Their arms and chest muscles bulged with mass and power. They weren't dozing on the job as he had figured, either. They were alertly scanning the crowd for early signs of trouble. Ryan doubted that they would actually intervene if a riot broke out on the main deck. There were too many cannies on tap with too many full auto blasters. It was more likely that they would retreat behind the bulkhead doors until the matter sorted itself out.
Interesting look. Think they take turns braiding each other's hair?
I believe there's an excellent possibility. Practitioners of the tonsorial arts must be in short supply in these parts.
Harlan Spruce showed up last. He took in the guards.
We can't shoot them down without having an unhappy mob on our asses.
We shall just have to resort to cold steel, then.
Doc unsheathed his rapier blade and held it behind his back, hidden by the long tails of his frayed frock coat. He carried the ebony sheath in his left hand as a counterbalance.
Shall we proceed?
Long before the four of them got within Doc's stabbing range of the guards, they were challenged.
Where the hell you think you're going?
To emphasize his authority, the angel on the right puffed out his chest and flexed his arm muscles. Ryan admired the skull branding the canny was thrusting in his face. He nodded in appreciation.
We need to see La Golondrina right away.
She never sees uninvited visitors, so back off.
Yeah, why don't you go beat on a railing or something? You do not understand the situation, my good fellow. This is a matter of some considerable urgency. We cannot possibly take no for an answer.
Looking at the tall scarecrow in front of him, the angel sneered in contempt. It was his last sneer of any kind. Doc used both hands and the power of his legs to drive the rapier's razor point up under the tip of the canny's sternum and deep into his chest. The skewered canny stared down at the rapier's crossguard in horror. His eyes slitted in pain. His massive chest heaved. The cords in his neck stood out like steel cables. Blood seeped like red tears from the corners of the 2-inch wide wound. When the big canny didn't drop dead instantly, Doc followed through with a full power shoulder strike that knocked the angel over backward through the doorway. Together, they crashed to the deck inside the stairwell with Doc on top, still holding onto his sword. Ryan, Christie, and Sprue launched themselves at the other angel, overwhelming him with their sheer combined weight. As he gave ground, he stumbled over his dying comrade and the kneeling Doc tapped. For a moment, it was a free-for-all punch-out. The companions rolled around on the deck with the huge canny, landing blows to his face, doing their best to control his powerful arms, or failing that, block his hands from reaching his weapons. As hard as they fought, they couldn't keep him from standing again. Ryan let go of his grip on the flesh-eater's wrist. As he slipped around behind the canny's wide back, the one-eyed man drew his panga from its sheath. Finding the space between ribs with its point, he short-thrust the long knife under the angel's left shoulder blade. Then, with all his weight, rammed the length of the blade through the back of his heart. The panga's point popped out of the front of the angel's chest. A red steel tongue waggled from the branded skull's mouth. The tongue disappeared as Ryan ripped the blade out of the wound track. As the canny slipped to the deck, the tattooed skull mouth vomited a geyser of bright blood onto his boot tops. To pry free the buried rapier, Doc had to stand on the other canny's chest and use the strength of his legs. Sprue immediately started dragging the other body around the stairwell's corner.
No, Sprue. Leave them where they lie.
Ryan grabbed a torch from the wall. The staircase leading up was an all-metal affair, including the tiny grated landings. It was bolted to the well's inner and outer walls. When Ryan hit the steps running, they shifted sickeningly under his weight, pulling away from the outside wall. Ryan paused, arms spread for balance, and they sagged back in place.
Take it easy on these red-blasted stairs. They've seen better days.
With weapons drawn, they began carefully working their way up the stairwell. In some places, the treads had come loose from the steel risers and were only held down by the force of gravity. The slow going was frustrating, especially when an entire flight of steps started swaying under them and they had to stop altogether. When they reached the four-story landing, progress came to an abrupt halt. Above them, the staircase was missing a number of consecutive treads. If the companions had fallen off, there was nothing to stop them from dropping all the way to the main deck. Christie pointed at the gap with her wheel gun.
We might be able to jump it.
There's no telling from here what kind of shape the surviving steps are in. They might be loose, too. They come off when we landed.
There's got to be another way up.
There are a jumble of footprints in the dust on this landing. They seem to be leading in and out of the door. Perhaps that is the alternate route to the top.
Ryan opened the door and looked inside, his Sig Sauer up and ready. The deserted hallway ran in a straight line across the width of the bridge tower. On the right wall, spaced at regular intervals, was a series of metal doors, presumably leading to rooms deeper in the building. The left-hand wall was divided by a row of large windows, most of which had no glass. The floor was tracked with more footprints. Ryan waved the others in after him.
Looks like this is our detour. Watch those doors. We don't want any surprises.
As he passed the empty window frames, Ryan looked down on the deck. There was no sign of Cheetah Luis and his Cajuns in the bow, which was a good thing. In their overexcitement, a few of the cannies cut loose with bursts of blaster fire aimed toward the sky, which made Ryan glad that they hadn't made shooting the attack signal. Cheetah Luis was holding his fighters in check, just like he was supposed to. Through the door at the far end of the hallway was a mirror image landing and stairwell. The difference was, this one had all its treads.
I'll go first.
As the convoy master started up, lag bolts ripped out of corroded wall plates, slamming into the wall opposite. The staircase pulled away from its moorings. As Sprue dropped between the risers, the fat man somehow managed to get his arms up, and his fingers gripped on the edge of the tread above him.
Don't look down!
Sprue looked down.
Oh, fuck!
Beneath his stout legs was a straight 60-foot fall. Ryan cast aside the torch as Christy and Doc knelt and grabbed onto Sprue's wrists. The one-eyed man leaned way over Sprue's back and snatched a big handful of the seat of his pants. Working in unison, they hauled the fat man back to the relative safety of the landing. Sprue's face was beet red under his beard. He seemed more embarrassed than scared as he wiped his palms on his bib front.
Oh, shit! That was a close one. Maybe someone smaller should go first.
Ryan took the lead. Moments later, they emerged from the stairwell on top of the bridge.
Keep away from the edge. We don't want the cannies down on the deck to see what's going on.
Ahead, the broad, unrailed deck led to the side of the wheelhouse. There was no sign of Mildred or the Queen, and no sign of the fierce fighting they had heard from below.
Who the hell are you?
An angel emerged from the side door of the wheelhouse. He was a gray-bearded version, but still plenty solid through the chest and arms. He had the same decoration on his chest and the same pigtail hairdo as the others. He stepped forward and spread his tree trunk legs, standing between them and the entrance to the wheelhouse. Over his shoulder, on a sling, he carried a folding stock AK. His hand on the pistol grip made the blaster look very small indeed. He wasn't aiming it at them yet. Things were definitely tense, but not in the realm of deadly. The angel still had questions.
How'd you get up here?
Took the stairs.
No. Who let you up here?
Nobody let us do anything. We just walked up.
That's crap. And you know it, asshole. There were two guards stationed on the entrance.
Never saw them. Maybe they were on a break.
We don't take breaks.
Four more angels stepped into view. All of them carried folding stock Kalashnikovs. They were uniformly large, well-developed, well-nourished specimens. One of them had thinning blonde hair, but he still sported the pineapple head braids.
Okay. It's time for you idiots to go back where you came from. If you don't move it right now, we're going to blow your fucking asses off this tower.
The other angels took up firing stances behind him and brought their AKs to bear from the hip. These Sekhmen were accustomed to seeing trouble run the other way. They still had their safeties on. The companions didn't need any grave invitation. They scattered like a school of baitfish evading a predator, for an instant leaving the cannies struggling, flat-footed, caught between dropping their selector switches and choosing a moving target. Only in this case, the little fishes opened fire as they broke ranks. The gray-bearded angel was hit in the same instant by Ryan, Christy, Doc, and Sprue. The volley of lead blew apart his chest and head and slammed his lifeless body to the bridge wing's deck. The other four cut loose with their AKs, relying on intimidating firepower, not accuracy, to turn back an enemy. It might have worked before, but it didn't work this time. The companions weren't intimidated. They knew how to lower their heads and fight. It was all over in 30 seconds flat. During that span, roughly 75 rounds had been exchanged at close range. The four angels were down and out. The companions didn't have a scratch on them. Christy and Doc checked the bodies.
Are they all dead?
On their way to hell.
Get down!
Ryan shoved Christy away from the edge of the bridge. The others crouched well out of the line of fire. But no slugs whizzed overhead or whacked into the front of the wheelhouse.
What the hell are they shooting at?
Cautiously, they returned to the edge and looked over to see what was going on. Dozens of cannies fired their AKs wildly in the air as they wheeled and danced. They were shooting at absolutely nothing.
Madness, pure and simple.
Bastards got ammo to burn.
They think the shooting up here was part of the party. Look, they're waving at us.
Let's wave back.
Ryan picked up a Kalashnikov and stood on the edge of the roof.
Yeah, yeah. Happy New Year, you dumb fucks.
Cheetah Louise watched the wheelhouse from inside the entrance to the bow stairwell, puffing away on a fat stick of ganja, getting his edge on. Whether true or not, the Cajun was convinced that he moved faster and fought better after he dosed himself with crazy weed. The sense of calm that flooded over him provided him with a feeling of invincibility. It made him utterly fearless, but not startle-proof. The sudden torrent of blaster fire from the top of the tower set his heart racing. He took it to mean the bridge was under attack and that the companions had at least gotten that far. The cannies on the deck took it to mean something entirely different. As the shooting on the tower ended, they hoisted their blasters in the air and sprayed blaster fire into the night sky.
That's why shooting wasn't a signal for the all-out attack.
Cheetah Louise squinted his right eye to keep the curling, pungent smoke out of it. The signal was going to be unmistakable. That's what the one-eyed man had told him. He said he would know it when he saw it. And he was right. After a minute or two passed, behind the windows of the wheelhouse, flames started dancing and flickering, low at first like a campfire, but rapidly growing higher and brighter. The cannies on the deck didn't seem to notice what was happening up there, because they were too preoccupied with celebrating, or they were too close to the tower and had a bad angle of view. Cheetah Louise flipped away his weed and turned from the deck to four of his fighters standing just inside the entry.
Hold this doorway! Whatever you do, keep the bastards off the stairs!
Taking the steps two at a time, he raced down to A deck. He shoved his way through the fighters waiting for him there.
Come on!
He led the charge down the corridor toward the stern. When they burst through the armory door, JB was propping up an armload of plastic stock AK-47s alongside the 100 or so others he had already prepped for battle. Piles of loaded mags lay at his feet.
Now! We go now!
JB grabbed up his pump gun and joined the Cajuns as they ran down the hall for the captive hold. Cheetah Louise lifted the locking bar and swung the door open wide. Inside the hold, the seated and standing prisoners looked toward the doorway in terror. None of them moved. Under the circumstances, they could hardly be blamed for expecting the worst. Cheetah Louise gestured to the Cajun captives, stepping into the hold so they could see him.
Come on! It's a breakout!
When the Cajuns rushed for the door, the other prisoners came to life, leaping to their feet. They charged the exit in a human wave. JB pulled Cheetah Louise out of the way as they spilled out into the hall. Otherwise, he would have been trampled.
Keep moving down the hall! Keep on moving!
As the throng hurried by, a small, wiry man with shoulder-length white hair brushed past Cheetah Louise. JB reached out and grabbed his slender shoulder, pulling him nose to nose.
Jack! Jack!
JB was greatly relieved to find the albino still alive, but he could read no comparable emotion in those strange, ruby-red eyes. All he saw was hate. Bottomless hate that wanted out.
Where's Mildred?
Took her away. While ago. Scarface canny. Up to the bridge, maybe.
The bridge is on fire. Your friends captured it and set it ablaze.
If she was up there, then she's probably free now.
Farther down the corridor, JB could see the other Cajuns guiding the released captives single file into the armory. There, they were being handed long blasters and extra mags and ushered back out into the hall. A smooth, quick operation. Anybody who could carry an AK got one. All the prepped AKs were gone by the time JB and Jack got inside the armory. The last assault rifle went to the grieving fat man, who clutched it to his chest like a life preserver. The albino wasn't put out by the shortage. Jack picked a blaster at random from an open wooden crate, tested it, checking the barrel and action, and finally dry-fired it.
Shit, stamped steel crap.
He accepted the full magazine that JB handed him, slapped it into place, and chambered the first round.
Got some other goodies to take along with us.
JB directed Jack over to the rack of RPG-16s.
Grab yourself a launcher. I'll take one, too. Got a backpack for the heat rockets.
Out in the hallway again, when JB started to head for the bow, Jack stopped him.
Hold on the aft stairway on the main deck.
No, that route's got to stay open. That's where we're going to push the bastards. We start at the bow and sweep them toward the stern.
Jack gave JB a hard look.
We've already got a bunch of cannies locked in the crew quarters one deck down. We want to drive the rest of them below deck so we can jump off this stinking ship and blow it and them clean to hell. Get it?
The albino showed JB a feral smile. He got it now. They moved through the ranks of the well-armed escapees to join the Cajun fighters at the head of the line. Cheetah Louise stood on the landing, ready to lead them up to the main deck and into battle. From the hallway's end, he jumped to the right of the landing, to the side with the staircase leading down. Above him was the underside of the stairway leading up and the landing on the main deck. Seven of his fighters crossed the gap in single bounds. Packed shoulder to shoulder, they pointed their blasters straight up and cut loose. They shot holes through the landing, through the treads, up through the soles of Kenny boots, through legs, through backsides, into spines. Bodies began to slide and topple down the steps. With the exit above cleared, the Cajuns ran up the steps, over the Kenny's sprawled bodies. JB and Jack followed them up the well. As the companions reached the end of the first flight of stairs and were about to make the turn to the top, Cheetah Luis and the fighters on point opened fire again. A gap opened on the steps above, but the Cajuns ducked and dodged the ricochets. JB charged upstairs and onto the landing. Cheetah Luis and the others had their backs to the walls. They were reloading again. As JB made for the doorway, more Kennys rushed through it.
Time to move! Let's go! Let's go!
The rest of the Cajuns and the freed captives behind them began scrambling up the steps.
Find some cover!
Eager for revenge, the first five or so spilled out of the doorway onto the main deck. The Cajuns went down hard without firing a shot in return. As they lay on the deck, bullets plucked at their clothes, sallying their bodies from the left and the right. Cannies were waiting for them on either side of the bow. JB recalled the foredeck's layout. There was an anchor windlass and mooring winch. There were bits, too, the solid steel, barred-like posts that guided the anchor and mooring lines. All were matched in size to the enormous vessel. Solid, ample, bulletproof cover for staging an ambush. Cheetah Luis rushed forward, blocking the doorway so no one else could step out.
Let's clean house!
Reaching into the pack of one of his fighters, he took out a pair of foot-long pipe bombs. Striking a wooden match on his thumbnail, he lit both fuses at once. As they sputtered in his hand, his lips moved silently. He was counting down. When there was about an inch of unburned blast cord, the Cajun chucked both bombs out the doorway to the left, to the ship's high side. They hit the deck near the bulwark, then they started rolling back down the slope toward the center. Cheetah Luis turned his back to the doorway and hunched over. The deck shook underfoot and sent hot shrapnel singing through the air. JB poked his head around the steel jam for a look-see. The explosions had put a sudden end to the canny ambush. On the bombed side, behind the windlass, was a wide, blackened section of deck. Half a dozen bodies, whole or in parts, lay strewn there, smoking. On the low side of the bow, Kenny slipped away, low and fast, heading for the cover of the deck hatches.
Get him! Don't let him get away!
JB knew the Cajun wasn't talking to him, not with a short-barreled scattergun in his hands. As he pulled back, a pair of very eager released prisoners pushed by him. They opened up on the running Kennys with their AKs, sending bullets zipping down the length of the ship. They dropped five of the bastards. When their guns locked back empty, they jumped back to cover inside the entry, looking mighty proud of themselves. From his position beside the door, JB could see the wheelhouse totally consumed by flames. The windows were all blown out by the heat. There was no sign of the companions.
Come on, Jack. Let's do some damage.
He didn't have to ask twice. Jack beat him through the doorway, and they both bolted for the cover of the windlass about 50 feet away, lugging RPG launchers and bagged rockets. Slugs skipped on the deck and whined around their ears as they slid in behind the massive machine. Cheetah Luis slid in beside them.
How about doing a little RPG number on the bastards? Blow them out of their socks!
Not possible. If I had a vertical target to shoot at, it'd be different. I got nothing but horizontal targets here. An armor-piercing warhead might skip off a hatch cover on the deck. Fly right up into the tower. Pipe bombs won't penetrate that sheet steel. Heat rounds will, big time. Might chill our friends up there by accident.
But they're still alive!
JB didn't say anything. The Kennys had lost control of two-thirds of the main deck. The range for bomb tosses had dropped precipitously. Cover for the backpedaling Kennys had fallen off as well. They were trapped with the tower at their backs. At that moment, the Kennys broke and ran, fleeing for the stairwells at the base of the tower. From behind the hatches, their ex-prisoners poured fire into and around the doorways. The full auto bursts and slugs flying 20 or 30 feet off target. The last of the Kennys dove through the doorway and disappeared. When all the shooting stopped, the initial silence was eerie. Spent brass was strewn everywhere. Bodies lay everywhere. More than 100 were dead, by JB's guess. It was impossible to sort out the ratio of Kennys to Norms. Two of Cheetah Luis's men raced unchallenged to the stairwells the Kennys had just entered. Each unshouldered his pack and took out a pipe bomb, After lighting its fuse, they threw the bomb back into its pack, then slung the pack down the stairs.
That's it! Regroup! Everybody regroup! Pick up the wounded! Head for the ramp! We out of here!
The surviving Cajuns directed traffic, steering the jubilant prisoners and the injured toward the only exit. Before the first captive reached the bottom of the ramp, sniper fire clattered from the tower windows. As the free folks streamed down the slope, they were chopped down. Some jumped off the ramp to escape. Some turned and emptied their auto weapons at the tower. Others just dropped their blasters and ran.
Can you do something now, JB?
JB pushed his spectacles back up the sweaty bridge of his nose. He figured Ryan and the others had to be off the freighter by now. Knowing them, they were waiting down by the cargo containers, where they could give covering fire while the prisoners made their exodus. JB unshouldered his RPG, knelt on the deck, and took careful aim up at the sniper's window. He pulled the launcher's trigger. The rectangular window had been transformed into a ragged, blackened circle.
Woo! That'll make the bastards think twice! Hurry them up! Help the wounded! Pick up the pace!
JB and Jack backed down the ramp with the last of the Cajuns, ready to fire back at the ship if anything moved. The captives who had kept their weapons and their ammo were using them on the canny smoker tenders, either shooting them down like dogs or driving them off into the marsh for the gators to finish. When they passed the cargo containers, the companions were nowhere to be seen. The path ahead was choked with running people. For JB and Jack, it was a hard slog. They were loaded down with more than their fair share of armament. Two blasters, two RPG-16s, and a bag of extra rockets.
Where are Ryan and the others, JB?
There was no sign of their friends in front, either. Certainly they would have shown themselves by now if they were really off the ship. JB felt the bottom fall out of his stomach.
Don't know. But if they're still on the boat, they'll fight their way out. They always do.
He was trying to think positive. After they'd gone about 300 yards, Cheetah Louise stopped the file.
This is far enough. You got to build the ship now, before Kenny's break out.
We're too close. Remember all that RDX in the armory? The blast perimeter is farther out. Most of that 100,000 tons of metal back there is gonna go flying. About half of that is coming in our direction. What doesn't go sideways and cut off our heads will fall straight down and cut us in two. Besides, our friends might still be inside.
Let's go then!
Cheetah Luis waved his fighters on. The refugees ran in a tight pack, filling the path from edge to edge. When they had retreated another 300 yards, near the limit of the RPG's range, the Cajuns stopped them again.
Far enough!
Yep.
Good angle!
They were parallel to the side of the grounded ship. It sat there, a big, fat target, waiting to get punched. JB and Jack got their RPGs ready. They lined up extra rockets. Then they shouldered the launchers.
Come on, Ryan, come on!
What are you waiting for?
Give it another minute. They could still be coming.
They're either already out or they chilled, and they're never coming out. Time to let fly!
Cannies were firing on them with sniper rifles. The way the captives were jammed together on the path, the bastards couldn't miss, even at 600 yards.
If the cannies get off that ship before we blow it, this game's over, and we lose. Fire them!
Not yet. Not yet.
Cheetah Louise shoved the muzzle of his M16 hard against the armorer's cheek.
If you don't shoot, little man, I will.
Her arm locked behind her back, Dr. Mildred Wyeth was hustled from La Golondrina's presence. The pair of angels forced her down a narrow corridor to the rear of the wheelhouse, where a cramped, low-ceilinged, windowless room had been converted into a kitchen. A big cast-iron pot simmered on a pre-dark all-electric stove, which had been crudely customized so it could burn wood. With the stove stoked up, the room's air temperature was well over 100 degrees. Hanging on the wall beside the cooktop was a selection of cast-iron fry pans, from huge to tiny. On the shelves above the unfinished plywood-on-sawhorse counter were condiments looted from conquered villes and ransacked farms, coiled necklaces of red chili peppers, bundled thyme and rosemary sprigs, mason jars full of black peppercorns and bay leaves, beakers of salt, blue antifreeze jugs of joy juice for marinades. Everything on the spice shelves was employed in the preparation of savory meats. Despite her fear, Mildred guessed that all of the Queen's meals were cooked here by her angels. That included the slicing and dicing. Next to the blazing wood stove was a 2-foot-wide chopping block. Its upper surface was deeply dished out and splintered, from two energetic swings of the cleaver. It wasn't the kind of block found in a four-star restaurant. It was the kind of block found in a prison courtyard on execution day. In the 5-gallon pot on the front of the stove, a soup stock was bubbling and steaming. She could see a pile of gray rib bones sticking up from the foaming surface, bones cooking to mush and releasing their rich marrow. One of the angels picked up a wooden ladle and carefully skimmed off the thick skin of greenish froth, which he flung unceremoniously in a plastic slops bucket. Then he used the ladle to dip some of the vile bouillon into another, smaller cooking pot. A head-sized pot.
Don't put in so much of that fucking broth this time. She likes it mixed with plenty of fresh blood.
The angel holding her arm wrestled her over to the chopping block. When he tried to make her bend over it, she resisted with all her strength, stomping on his toes, firing elbow shots into his ribs with her free arm. The huge man hitched her arm up higher on her back, and when the spearing pain froze her, he kicked her behind the knees. Her legs gave way, and she hit the floor.
That's an easer now.
The angel behind her leaned his full weight into her shoulders. She pushed back as hard as she could, but she couldn't stop him from forcing her head toward the chipped and gouged hollow. He made her bend over even further, pressing down until her neck lay across the splintered block.
Don't you struggle and make me miss my first swing. You don't want me to have to take a second cut, believe me. If I don't chill you on the first swing, it's gonna hurt like hell.
Mildred had no intention of giving him a first swing, no intention of going out nice and easy. The angel at the stove took hold of the heavy stockpot's wire handle, preparing to hoist it onto another burner. At the peak of his lift, Mildred lashed out with her right foot as hard as she could. She caught him square on his weight-bearing leg, just above the ankle. The kick didn't knock him down, but it knocked him off balance. He fell forward onto the red-hot stove, and the stockpot in his hands tipped over, sending blanched ribs and boiling water sheeting down his bare chest. He joined her on the floor on his knees, his mouth and outstretched fingers trembling in agony. Startled by the turn of events, the angel behind her relaxed for a second, letting the pressure off her back and arm. In this case, a second was long enough. Mildred wrenched loose of his grip, and once free, scrambled around the chopping block. As she lurched past the scalded canny, she snatched his sword from its scabbard. Instinctively, the wounded flesh eater raised his hand to protect the side of his neck. Mildred pivoted from the hips, putting everything she had into the sword slash. The blade passed cleanly through his forearm at the wrist. The edge stopped, only when it came apart against his spinal column. As it turned out, there were worse things than a third-degree burn. Mildred booted him in the shoulder as she jerked the blade free of his neck. The edges of the slash gaped wide. The clipped ends of the vessels looked like pink soda straws. Eyes bulging, the angel tried desperately to staunch the tremendous flow of blood. His efforts were in vain. He had only one hand to work with, and he had sustained two mortal wounds. Blood squirted in all directions, from the stump of his arm and from his cut jugular.
Go in for it now. I'm gonna chop you up in little bitter pieces.
The other angel took a practice cut with his sword as Mildred backed away.
You're more than welcome to try.